Today's talk is given by Chris Fleet, Senior Map Curator at the National Library of Scotland. His talk is entitled New GIS Technologies for Historical Maps. Chris joined the National Library of Scotland in 1994, having previously worked for the Bodleian Library, Oxford, and the National Library of Wales. His work at NLS has heavily involved scanning and digital delivery of historical mapping and utilisation and development of simple digital map applications. Chris has recently been the recipient of the Royal Scottish Geographical Society's Bartholomew Globe, as well as being awarded an honorary fellowship with the Society. Chris is also a long-term collaborator with the University of Edinburgh, today colleagues here in geography, with some of whom he is co-author of the recent book, Scotland, Mapping the Nation. Now out in, is it paperback or softback? One of two. And he's also worked on major projects such as Addressing History and the Visualising Urban Geographies project, as well as many other modern web and mobile map applications. So Chris is ideally positioned to give us a fascinating talk about the state of the art in historical map-based research. Chris.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that that kind introduction. I'm not sure quite how ideally placed I am. I ought to be well placed to do this, but it's a very nice opportunity to address an audience who, in part, I know quite well, but not well right across the board. And I hope that there'll be something new, at least here for everyone. I'm aware of certain faces in the audience. I've given talks in the last year on new developments in online maps, and some of them may not seem that new to a few faces, but I hope there is something in there that's new for everyone. And I thought I'd set the scene just by saying a little more about the National Library of Scotland and our map collections. For those of you who don't know it that well, we're a very large map library with about 2 million maps. They cover all parts of the world. And we've been trying to promote web-based access to the collection now for nearly 2 decades. Our website has about 50,000 high-resolution zoomable images of maps now available, mostly relating to Scotland in the last 4 centuries. And just to show a few images of those sorts of things, just to show a few images, they include maps of the whole of Scotland, of detailed ordnance survey maps from the last century and a half, county maps. We have military maps as well, including the Boy Military Survey of Scotland, and related battle plans, a battle plan here of Culloden. Estate plans as well, detailed rural maps before the Ordnance Survey. And quite a number of specialist early collections, the Pont manuscript maps are the earliest detail mapping covering Scotland from 4 centuries ago. We also have a large collection of marine charts which show both coastal areas and offshore areas as well. And these maps, the online maps especially, are used for a very wide variety of purposes. It won't surprise you to understand really the kind of main constituents are family history, local history, archaeology, environmental risk review, land ownership, but a range of other purposes as well. Each day our website has about 1,500 visits and about 12,000 page views. And although free access for me personally is very much the main priority and will certainly remain the case for the foreseeable future, we do also have an income generation side which keeps our paymasters happy, allowing people to order printouts and images and photocopies. And this is the map images homepage, which amongst other things illustrates the 2 main ways of accessing everything, by place, a geographic approach, and also by category. And it's really this spatial access that new GI technologies have particularly facilitated. Now my aim today is not so much to present a great chest-beating ego trip of how great the maps website an NLS is, because there's many aspects of it that I'm certainly less than happy about. And I would say, and I'll say this as we go through, the most impressive parts, I think, of the technologies have actually been developed by other people, particularly a chap called Petter Friedel of Glocken Technologies, who I've known well for several years as an open source developer. But we've also collaborated with a number of bodies in the university and beyond in the open source community. And so what I'm keen to try and do today is to highlight those aspects of our technologies that I think might have a broader value for you, and particularly highlighting the potential for collaborative work, the opportunities there are, I think, through these technologies for better spatial retrieval, for finding geographic resources, and also for better delivery of spatial information in the form of historic maps. But I'm also very keen for ideas and suggestions, especially for new things that we can do and other projects that we don't know about. And so what I've also tried to do to kind of indicate generally our direction for the future is to look very much at what we're doing in terms of having a collection of paper maps down here and a body of users out there. Most of what I'm going to talk about today is very much in terms of the delivery side. And it does seem, I think, as if a lot of that is changing quite rapidly. These have a very short-term lifespan. But the hope is that down at the bottom level, a lot of what we're doing doesn't need to keep being repeated over and over again. Whenever we scan things, we record detailed metadata about it and store, hopefully, good quality TIFF master images that will have a very long-term value. And from those, we make derivative images, georeferenced images. The data here is often repurposed for other more useful formats for the online audiences, and especially things like shapefiles and bounding boxes that I'll mention. We've got a number of kind of, I think, quite busy projects that don't easily coalesce together into something coherent. So what I try to do is to gather these various projects into three main themes. First of all, a general theme of improving access, trying to find stuff in improved ways. Secondly, the potential of georeferencing, by georeferencing maps, making new applications, web map services, and so on available. And I'll mention briefly at the end a little about open source technologies and our experience of those, although in practice, as we see, they underpin most of the new stuff we've been doing and finding things and making things available. So, first of all, looking at the access side, I think we've only recently, fairly recently, exploited the full potential of georeferencing as a better means of discovering maps through improved search and retrieval. And I think this can be best illustrated through our what we call now our Find by Place viewer. Most people are obviously interested in geographically where maps relate to. And the Find by Place viewer provides a way of accessing all of our online maps by their location through this particular portal. The idea is that the user selects a particular category of maps that they're interested in from this left-hand side menu here. I could, for example, show another category like the Bartholomew Survey Atlas, and the sheet lines of that particular category are illustrated in this main viewer. By then clicking, by selecting in the main map window the area of interest, all the maps that cover that location are shown in the right hand panel and are also highlighted in the main map window. Google Google Gazetteer through the Google API provides a very versatile way of accessing content. Not ideal as a gazetteer, especially for rural areas, but very good for postcodes and streets and urban areas. We also have a drop-down set. And with my mouse, I'm not pointing in the right direction. Should I be pointing it here?
No, I think it should be.
Okay. Just have to bear with me in my slides. Follow me on. We also have a drop-down set of counties from parishes that position the main map window on the county and parish. And it's very easy as well to have a set of different backdrop layers of Google Maps or an historic map backdrop layer from the 1920s for the main map window. And it's worth very briefly looking at the prehistory of this application, because we began in 2004 with Esri's ARC IMS providing access to a much smaller quantity of our maps. And the basic idea was quite similar, although the application looks and was very clunky by today's standards. You zoomed on in, selected a particular map, and then by clicking on the map could then view the details about it and move on to a zoomable viewer that we'll see a bit later on. We found a number of problems of ARC IMS. We had quite an expensive application with annual licensing. The web mapping functionality was quite limited. The application, certainly in the way we had set it up, wasn't particularly stable, especially with high usage spikes. It crashed and we needed to reboot and reset everything to get it going again. We designed the screen around a fixed width, which was fashionable years ago, but obviously fairly unfashionable these days. And also based everything on the British National Grid rather than the global spherical Mercator projection. So not really making it easy to take advantage of web mapping APIs. And Glocken Technologies were selected in 2011 to develop a replacement for this using open source technologies. And we used GeoServer and OpenLayers. You may well know about GeoServer. We found it very, very versatile, good open source server software. It's all written in Java, and it allows users to share and edit geospatial data. GeoServer also has got close links with the Open Geospatial Consortium, and is very good on standards, on publishing data in the main web map service, WMTS, and web feature service standards. This shows the administration interface for GeoServer and the various shapefile layers that were our bounding box layers for particular maps. And GeoServer also works very well with open layers. It presents the shapefiles through a kind of standard open layers viewer. And open layers, which we've used very, very extensively on the website, a very, very well-written, versatile JavaScript library, which allows a range of viewing applications that I'm sure many of you know that can be easily built and combined with other applications and websites. And also GeoServer links in with GeoWebCache, which allows a much faster delivery of geodata by pre-caching the shapefiles at a number of commonly used zoom levels, so they're instantly available, they're not delivered by the application itself. The main metadata content of the application then is bounding boxes of geographic extents held as shapefiles. And we obtain these from a number of sources. We use the Adena Share Geo repository. We were able to obtain historical jurisdictions as counties and parishes from a project with Humphrey Sovell of the Vision of Britain project. And we also were able to obtain shapefile bounding boxes from the Charles Close Society, who are the main society for historical ordnance survey maps, and they developed an application, a really useful application called SheepFinder, which has a JavaScript set of files holding the boundaries of all of the historic ordnance survey maps for Great Britain. And we also used the GDAL to index command, which is very useful if you happen to have a georeferenced mosaic of sheets in a series. So we would mosaic together the sheets of a particular series, and then from the geotiffs use the GDAL to index command to create a shapefile of those extents, which can then be easily used for querying online. So the results we were very pleased with, and the advantage too of linking with open layers was that many scripts were already pre-written, for example, for things like the scale bar down here, and also, although it's not on this screenshot, the national grid also appears in the lower right-hand corner. And this was a very easy script from a website called Movable Type that have very helpfully written all the code for converting from lat-long to national grid. And so those sorts of components were very easy to add in there without doing the work ourselves. So by holding the bounding box extents, which for the first time we did only late last year for everything that we've got online, it then becomes possible to deliver effectively the information out to other web portals in terms of better spatial queries. And a couple of the most important portals for us have first of all been Scotland's Places, and secondly, Old Maps Online. Now, Bruce in the audience is very much the driving force, I think, behind the technology of Scotland's Places. But essentially it allows very good, federated, dynamic, spatial searching of different websites based upon their geographic holdings. The collaborative portal that the Royal Commission on Ancient and Historic Monuments of Scotland run and have their own content in also now includes content from the National Records of Scotland and NLS. But essentially by combining together a number of typical familiar search methods by map, by counties and parishes and places, spatial queries are dynamically done, the results delivered back as XML files, and so for an institution like ours in NLS, we don't supply any images or metadata to Scotland's Places. We simply respond with XML query results, which can then provide zoomable images in conjunction with the results from the other websites as part of the portal. I'll also mention in passing about Scotland's Places that continues to grow as it gets more content, that it is very well organized in terms of allowing the pages to be spiderable by Google and other search engines. Quite often, as you'll know, with geographic queries, they are not spiderable by Google search engines, which are still very much based upon textual queries. And this allows place name queries, particularly, to lodge through to a specific page, and the results are displayed for that page, so that the geography and the geographic search is actually done by the system, but delivering an immediate result to the world at large. And the other portal, which has grown steadily in importance to now become the world's largest portal to online images of historic maps, is Old Maps Online. The technology is very much Peter Priedel's of Blocken Technologies, but the funding from JISC this year, particularly through Humphrey Southall in the Vision of Britain project, has allowed it to be steadily developed and expand in content. It's quite a different sort of interface, and it's interesting to compare how very different all these three interfaces are to what is, when we look at Scotland, primarily the same concept. But the idea behind Old Maps Online is it presents a dynamic set of images that best match the spatial area, the spatial extent that you've got in the main map screen here. So it combines the geographic extents with the scale of the mapping as well. And it's also very scalable. It now has over 160,000 maps in there that are effectively instantly available. And in the next few weeks, the site's also going to be revamped to provide landing pages too for particular locations around the world, again to improve website traffic. So that's my first theme, really, looking at finding and discovering maps using GI technologies. And now I'd like to move on to look at georeferencing, which has actually had a greater impact on us in the last few years. Just to say at the outset, georeferencing, I think, offers a number of important advantages for libraries. Improved retrieval and user interfaces, as we've seen. Better understanding of maps, potentially allowing their geometric or spatial properties to be analysed. It also allows the ability to compare them more easily to one another, either as overlays or as side-by-side screen comparisons. And it also allows a greater ability to share the maps through dynamic web services. And for us, the georeferencing process has typically involved adding control points. It can be simply two or three control points for an Ordnance Survey map where we have the bounding box shapefile. But for many earlier maps, it involves considerably more points to align it with geographic reality. And the four main areas I'll look at quickly are preparing georeferenced overlays of historic maps and presenting those, web map services, our historic maps API, and also the georeferencer project. Image mosaics are georeferenced. They need to be prepared for rapid web delivery. And the way that most people have done that is by tiling the georeferenced mosaics into a set of zoom levels and quite small 2x6 by 2x6 tiles for specific areas. So at any one time, the quantity of information delivered is very small. And this takes advantage of the fact that Google Maps and Bing and other geodata APIs use this spherical Mercator projection and a similar tiling profile, so that the extents of all tiles, as well as the zoom levels, are predefined for the whole Earth. And therefore, georeferenced maps, such as our historic ones over on this side, once they're tiled, will present effectively the right tile at the right time as an overlay and form the impression of being a seamless mosaic. And we make available now 160 mosaics, which take up about 2.5 terabytes of disk space, now through our Explore Georeferenced Maps viewer. And this viewer has, as you can see, deliberately similar search functionality to the Find by Place viewer, by gazetteer, by county, parish drop-down, and by zooming in on the map. A set of drop-down lists on this side allow a particular historic mosaic to be selected in the foreground, so we can say select a 6-inch to the mile map from the 1890s, and then zoom in on that 6-inch to the mile map to display the detail of it. I know that's a bit tricky to see on this screen, but in the top left-hand corner is a transparency slider. And this is a really easy line of code from jQuery uses a jQuery bit of JavaScript that means when we slide the transparency to the left, I can see I'm halfway there, and then hopefully record two completely to the left, the historic layer disappears and reveals whatever layer you choose to show up here, either Google Satellite or Bing or OpenStreetMap or whatever. And so as well as being actually a great fun application to use, the viewer allows quite an easy comparison of one map to another by toggling between them on this left-hand side, or comparing the historic map to the present day. And through this application, we were very easily able to repurpose it towards other more specific projects. One of those last year, called The Great Escapes of Moray, was actually an iPhone application developed for schools in Moray, and by giving it a different wrapper and style, and you can see as well the slightly older style of OpenLayers Pan Zoom Bar that we had then. The same types of maps with the same functionality can be easily delivered up to a new audience. And we've just recently done this too, in conjunction with the Bartholomew exhibition in the National Library of Scotland, developing a set of Bartholomew half-inch to the mile maps for the whole of Great Britain, and allowing you to slide the transparency easily from a 1900s layer to the present day, which is revealed when you slide the transparency slider to the far right. And this little application down here provides a way of comparing four Bartholomew maps at different points in time. Bartholomew continually experimented with their palette of colours for showing layers, for showing relief. And so by toggling between them, you can compare the two on screen at the same time, as well as the legend for them. And this is a really easy application to do, just using open layers and the tile sets for those maps. It's also possible to allow historic maps to be delivered into other websites using open standards, particularly web map services, the web tile map service protocol, and also the web feature service protocol for features. And a growing number of external websites now use various overlays from us, which we're pleased are gradually improving in robustness over time. In the beginning, we were rather more embarrassed about them not working than working, but fortunately, I hope those days are largely over. This shows the historic maps as a layer inside Bruce's gazetteer for Scotland, and we also have something similar to that we developed for the open street map community, where the historic out of copyright maps for Great Britain are provided as a backdrop within their main maps editor, JOSM, and it also allows people to trace features that haven't changed in the last 50 years as another layer that they can use effectively for open street mapping. And fortunately too, through the OpenStreetMap publicity, it encouraged a volunteer, a chap I never met, from Ireland, who liaised by email and volunteered to georeference historical maps of Ireland, which he did, and also available through the OpenStreetMap editors and available on our websites. And I'll just mention here before I forget that if any of you or know people who are interested in georeferencing historical maps, then please do get in touch. I'm always very happy to discuss collaborative projects on that front. We've also collaborated with Edinburgh University in the form of the Visualising Urban Geographies project. Now, this project tried to create tools for historians, particularly using digitized and georeference maps in conjunction with other historical information. I think we all saw it as something of a pilot project. It's actually not that new now, so I'll skip over it quite quickly. But perhaps in passing mention that we created a set of guides for georeferencing maps, transforming maps between projections, and putting them online that describe in practice our workflow that we've adopted for our own maps, and also all of the resources that we made available which focused on Edinburgh, historical maps of Edinburgh and boundaries of Edinburgh, all available for free onward use as georeferenced images, tile map services, KML and shapefiles where relevant as well. And they're also inside the share geo resource. And it also allowed quite fun projects. I'm not sure necessarily how educational this is. This is Bartholomew's wonderful chronological map of Edinburgh that colour codes the historical developments of Edinburgh over time by georeferencing it and overlaying it on Google Earth. We could obviously zoom in and explore it, but what we also did was to vectorize the information and present it as a KML layer inside Google Earth that again provides another alternative illustration of what can be done really by georeferencing maps. And I'll just mention as well, we were very pleased to hear in the last month that the AHRC are going to fund a follow-on project to visualising urban geographies to create an electronic atlas of Edinburgh. It'll be a three-year project beginning in September, and the funding has gone to Edinburgh University, the History Department, and also to geography here. So we hope to do a lot more with electronic mapping and other spatial data relating to Edinburgh. I'll quickly mention an addressing history project. This was a collaborative project that ADINA were funded to do, looking at the potential for making available directory information, street directory information, along with historical maps. And this was something of a pilot project illustrating the potential, just focusing on a few directories, parsing the contents of the directories, splitting them up into people, places and occupations, and then georeferencing that content. But I think there's a great potential in this whole area of georeferencing historical gazetteers, directories and other content, and then exposing it through resources using historic maps as well. The historic maps API was very much Petter Friedel's idea. The main aim was to explore the potential for making available historic maps as a web service for embedding inside other websites. Various web mapping APIs like Google, Bing and so on focus very much on contemporary mapping, and this specifically promoted the use of historic maps in online mashups. We georeferenced a set of maps of Great Britain from smaller scales, 1 to 1 million, a quarter inch to the mile and the 1 inch to the mile scale. And they were tiled using the open source map tiler, and then distributed on 4 servers for more rapid and stable web delivery. And the historic maps API was actually launched nearly 3 years ago in May 2010. We didn't really promote it at the beginning. We just allowed people to use it if they discovered it. And in the early months of 2011, we were discovered by a website called Where's the Path, which I'll illustrate in a moment, that it's a very, very intensively used website. And through the Where's the Path, suddenly it's forced this sort of storm surge in our user stats, but it also increased the popularity of it in other applications as well. Sasha, I was just looking for this presentation. In the 2.5 years to January 2013, we recorded 1.6 million visitors, 2.8 million page views. It's about 2,000 to 3,000 visits per day. And quite a broad user community. This is the Where's the Path application, allowing a modern map on one side and an historic map on the other. Outdoor leisure and recreation was probably the biggest user, but through that we also were able to add layers to various smartphone applications. Archaeology was a really big user. It's a portable antiquity scheme that uses it as an historic map layer. Family history, local history, and a number of other specialist websites. This is the Sabre Road History website. This is the Society for All British Road Enthusiasts. Yes, you don't know. I love their logo. Brilliant logo. And a site called Stravaging around Scotland, which is all about roaming, and it's got historic castles and buildings and so on, which is displays our historic maps there as well. I've jumped on slightly too fast. And we have quite big plans for extending out the API, but sustainability is something of an issue. And so we've got now a lot more layers that we can add. If you're interested in the MapTiler format, the latest MapTiler cluster, as it's called, creates a format called MBTiles, which is a much more versatile format for placing onto web servers. It avoids the use of lots and lots of smaller tiles. It's an open format developed by Mapbox. And when GDAL 2.0 supports the Mapbox format, hopefully this year, it'll allow a really quick and easy way of delivering web map services from tile sets, which is something that we found slightly tricky to do. It's another process for us using another GIS. So given all the potential of georeferencing, there should be perhaps potential in crowdsourcing, harnessing the crowd to help us with the task of georeferencing resources. And there have been a few applications developed along those lines. Metacarta Map Rectifier was developed by a chap called Tim Waters to form the map Warper open source software. And this has been used by the New York Public Library, amongst other bodies, as an online georeferencer. Through our loyalty to PETA and Quokken Technologies, we've linked up with his map georeferencer, which actually has very similar functionality. And what it basically allows people to do is choose from a number of maps. They can select their map, and then it opens inside a split-screen viewer with the historic map on this side, a modern map on this side, and it's also possible to have a range of different layers here, like OpenStreetMap and Google and Bing and so on. You zoom on in on any place on the historic map, add a control point, do the same on this side, and when you've added enough control points, you can then save and exit, and the map is georeferenced for you, displayed as a layer inside the Google Earth browser plugin. Georeferencer has been developed quite fast in the last few years, and has steadily, I think, become an easier tool to use. We began with it, and it was a bit clunky for people to register. It didn't always work as well as it should have done. And so our success was perhaps not as great in the first year or so, but those libraries that have joined more recently, this is the Institut Cartographic de Catalunya, have had all their maps georeferenced in a matter of weeks of being released online. And it has a standard sort of widgets that show top-level georeferencers and pie charts of progress and that sort of thing to try and encourage crowdsourcing. And I think as this technology develops, to perhaps allow people to crop and mosaic lots of sheets together, then I think has a great potential too for allowing georeferencing, which we've always had very limited resources to do ourselves inside NLS. I'll just mention briefly a project that we've also collaborated on recently, trying to extend these technologies to other bodies. This is actually more a personal interest of mine, the Scotways Heritage Paths website. And originally, they displayed these historic paths as a KML layer on top of our historic maps. But through the GeoServer Open Layers technology, we were able to very easily set up a revised interface for them that keeps their heritage paths in a shapefile layer in GeoServer and allows all of our historic map layers to be included as a backdrop. And there's nothing at all that gets added to their website in terms of this content. It's simply JavaScript code and a revision to the HTML. And so that's the kind of project which I'm very keen to mention that might have applications in areas that you know about, but I won't know. And finally, if this is a small section, you'll be pleased to know, I was just going to mention, in summary, our experience of using open source technologies, because the potential of these has steadily grown and has allowed us to not only reduce costs, but also, I think, encouraged us to use more standards compliant services. A lot of the open source technologies have been very linked in with open standards, and also, I think, allow easier international collaboration on a long-term basis with a broad shared community. The GDAL suite of software we have used very much show how great we were with command lines. Often these seem quite clunky to use but have great power, and often have been bundled together in things like QGIS that allow us to do a lot of what we've done with historic maps. And so I was keen to mention those briefly in passing. And Open Layers has also been the key to a lot of our delivery of images online. Historically, we used the Mr. Sid proprietary compression format for delivering ungeo-referenced images, but there are a number of problems with this viewer. The fixed image extents on screen, you clicked and then it was a full refresh. Limited ability to display the image in a wrapper, and various printing and downloading limitations. And again, through Buchan Technologies, we were able to develop an open layers viewer that uses the same Mr. Sid images, but in a much more versatile, dynamic way. Slippy mapping, a very easily configurable header and footer, and taking advantage as Open Layers develops of standard free upgrades for the Open Layers JavaScript library. We are hoping in the next few months that we'll also move our Mr. Sid Express server to a software called IIP Image, which you may know is completely open source and has also just been configured for Windows servers, which is what they use in NLS. And our Open Layers viewer will plug very easily into IIP Image, so we've got very minimal redevelopment. That's the way the Open Layers viewer looks now inside our current sort of wrapper and footer. So you can give a consistent look and feel to the website and the viewing of it with the same sort of style sheets and so on. I was going to very briefly summarise too our experience of open source software, because it hasn't all been great, I have to say. Amongst the advantages are those that I've mentioned particularly, and certainly for us they've allowed a step change in terms of functionality. But I do feel with the ones we've used that There's a greater need for programming language to get them to work well. There's more need for development work. There's fewer kind of off-the-shelf, ready-to-go applications. They've been more time-consuming to develop and support. When things go wrong, often it involves Googling and Googling over error messages and problems that can take, certainly it seems like, days to try and track down and find at the end of one long email thread someone else who's also got the same problem as you but hasn't got a solution either. Also, we've had to, as you can gather, pay for external development, but it's a relatively affordable thing. So yeah, in summary, I think these technologies allow a great potential, certainly we feel as libraries, to make available maps and related resources in new ways and allow them to be consumed by a growing number of portals and deliver them as collaborative web services to other institutions. Many library collections are inherently geographical, not just maps. We've got a range of other geographic resources. And as these steadily get geocoded over time, it hopefully will allow even more successful automated ways of presenting them online. And yeah, just to reiterate really that I'm always keen to hear from people who would like to work with us or have got ideas for using our maps or other applications. Most of what we've done very much through other people doing the clever bit or doing the work. So I'm very grateful to the broader community for supporting that. Just because I was asked to bring PowerPoint to go on the web, I thought I should give some references and URLs as well, which are not for reading now, but I would suggest the ePerimetrum website, for those of you who don't know, very useful project on historical maps and digital technologies. And PETA's old Maps Online site has a range of very useful links on open source technologies for historic maps as well. Finally, just to mention two, for those of you who don't know, there's an exhibition on Bartholomew's maps. I brought along little flyers that I've got at the front that's on until the 7th of May in the Georgia Fort Bridge building. And this looks very much at the production of Bartholomew's maps, looking behind the scenes at how maps were produced, which is a key strength of the Bartholomew archive in the National Library of Scotland. And just to say too, I also brought with me, I never come out and about empty-handed with leaflets and things to try and get rid of. We produce a newsletter called CARES, which if you haven't seen it, provides a twice-yearly update about historical maps of Scotland, sometimes new digital developments, new things on our website, new research, publications and so on. So do grab a copy. And we've also just completed facsimile atlas publishing project with Berlin, who are our neighbour publishers just around the corner in Edinburgh, which they grandly call the Great Atlas of Scotland project, and it's produced facsimile atlases of the main four big atlases of Scotland: the Blough Atlas of 1654, the Roy Military Survey of the mid-18th century, Thompson in the 1830s, and finally, just late last year, the Bartholomew Atlas as well. And I said to them, wherever I go, I'll encourage people to avail themselves of the opportunity to buy one of these atlases. So yeah, that's me done. Thanks very much indeed.
Well, thank you very much. Lots of stuff there, lots of stuff for our keen students to capitalise on. Questions? Straight in there, Chris.
You said at the start that there's a lot of things that you're not quite happy with that still need to be fixed. So what still needs to be fixed?
Sorry, I have to excuse my hearing there.
You said at the start that there's a lot of things that you're not quite happy with that need to be fixed.
Yes.
So what still needs to be fixed?
I was hoping you wouldn't ask that. I was hoping not to cover them. Well,
there's a huge amount of work involved, I think, in repurposing content. So one example would be, 10 years ago, we released a dedicated website for the Pont Maps that actually had a completely designed skin and content to it. And there's a number of limitations to that that have steadily grown over time. If we kind of learned the lesson of, kind of not doing things like that. So now we try to design everything in terms of flexible components that are delivered out of databases, or use wrappers that are very easy to change right across the whole website. And there's quite a bit of, I would say, legacy content that takes a lot of time to kind of repurpose into this sort of area. I think there are limitations as well, I would say, mainly because there's a continual growth of expectations in the world at large, because web mapping, I think, changes rapidly. Whereas 3 years ago, what we're doing now might have seemed really, you know, cutting edge. It can look very old hat very quickly, and people expect to, say, zoom in greater detail. Why isn't there, say, a gazetteer for all of these historic maps? You could click on a place and go to the place on a map. And actually, there's a long list, a long shopping list of things that we would like to do if we had more resources. But, you know, you can look at it both ways round. I'm very pleased that we're at least, you know, better than we were a few years ago. There's a lot more that we'd like to do.
I just wondered how the georeferencing works for older maps that are very not sort of spatially correct and distorted, and how that works. Because obviously you don't want to see a distorted map, you want to see the map as it was.
Yeah.
So if you're trying to fix it onto a modern map, it's going to be incredibly distorted.
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's something I didn't really cover, because I feel that maps of the last 200 years, particularly Ordnance Survey maps, are actually very easy to georeference with minimal distortion, because they're based on an accurate trigonometric and geodetic base. As soon as you go back before perhaps the mid-18th century, that doesn't hold true at all. And if you were to accurately georeference, say, a Blau map or a Pont map from 300 or 400 years ago, it would completely mangle it. And I feel actually it's better not mangled, it's better not georeferenced. What we did with the Roy map was something of a compromise, where we did a basic, I think they call it an affine transformation, where it was shifted and rotated to approximately relate to the geographic area of Scotland, but it involved no rubber sheeting with the georeference. There's kind of mathematics called polynomials that I don't understand. What I do know is that they will warp and bend the particular map the greater the degree of polynomial transformation. And if we'd done that to Roy, then it wouldn't have represented the original. And there's an important point about authenticity, I feel, for libraries, making things available as close as possible to the way that the originals look. One of the projects that we're working on now, and I think shows quite good promise, is a kind of split-screen application or something like the Pont Maps. And I was lucky enough a few months ago to receive from an enthusiast out there a gazetteer of all the names on the Pont Maps, and he'd also given me the pixel locations of the Pont Maps inside our viewer. Now with that, we can georeference those points, and what that means is you can hold the Pont Map on one side that's not georeferenced at all, it's simply in our own, if you like, viewer space as a zoomable image, but the pixels can relate to the real world, and so you can have the right-hand screen showing the area that you're covering. And for those of you who know the Pont Maps, you realise that the actual geography of it is recognisable, but often by assistance, and so it provides quite a clue there to doing it. But I'm actually quite keen to focus on modern-day georeferencing. In other words, maps that are geometrically accurate, first and foremost, because there's a huge amount to do with those, and our historic layers. We spent most of our time doing maps within the last 100 years, and there's a huge amount more to do, precisely for that reason, because the historic ones are with all sorts of related issues that can be problematic if they're not there.
Robert,
well,
most of them will just work across
Hi, Chris. How do you generate revenue to support all these great activities you've got here?
Revenue?
Yep.
You mean the revenue we get, or do you?
Yeah.
Do you
pay other people? Who pays for all this? Myself, the taxpayer, or?
Yeah. Well, it's a mixture. I hadn't realised we had taxpayers in here. Okay. Yeah. Well, as a taxpayer, you fund the NLS infrastructure, and you do pay for, I would say, the salaries of half of me and half of a colleague who are involved in this. But we're a really small-scale operation. There's no one else who works on our website. And a lot of the actual work is actually being done by collaborative projects that are often externally funded by companies. So, for example, in the last year, we were funded by a firm of chartered surveyors called Wilburn, based down in Sheffield, who actually funded georeferencing. And we've had other projects with the XYZ digital map company, who've also funded georeferencing of layers. Our online ordering facility allows people to buy photocopies and printouts and images, and that has a total income of about £50,000 a year. But probably, I would say, two-thirds of that is the cost of delivering, you know, paper and ink and the staffing. So that makes a small amount of revenue. But it's an area that I would really like to do a lot more of. I think there is a commercial potential in a lot of the mapping, but at the same time, our main remit is actually to provide a service to the people of Scotland, not to charge them for it. We don't want to kill collaborative projects or kill people's enjoyment of the maps at a basic viewing level. And it's getting that balance right of providing certain free services that I think should always be free if we're a national institution. And the way that it's free for you to come to the map library and view maps, you know?
I was in Ottawa last week and I had to pay $9 to go to the National Art Gallery, which I complained about. So yeah. I appreciate that.
But, yeah, I mean, one of the things we've been looking at is kind of charging based on usage for high-volume users, because especially with, I would say, geo-referenced web map services, there are people who want a robust application that will always deliver an historic map, and if they're making money out of that, which some of them are, and expecting these services to be there, then perhaps they should pay for it too. And so I think, you know, there's business models that we would like to explore, but it's partly, I'd say, reticence on my part, because I'm not keen to effectively privatise the content. I'd be much keener on it being provided as a service, just as a kind of underlying ethic, really.
I was going to really ask a question about the business model, because I find your approach quite a productive and a very, very interesting approach. So I've got two questions. One, the audience that I do who own Scotland stuff, and we're working together to revamp our website with your content. And our old website used to be free, but it can't be now because we have to pay. So, but if we get high volume, then you know we're more than happy to pass some of it on to you. So I think this whole kind of people working on a basis of kind of trust together, helping each other, expanding the market, expanding the possibilities that are there. Because what one finds is people see possibilities when they actually see data, when they see information, and which they wouldn't had they had not been able to get access to in the first place. So I'm just kind of wondering how difficult or easy was it to adopt a kind of open source business model? I mean, I know the data, you know, belongs to the public and we do have free access to it physically, therefore you should almost expect it to be free over the web as well, but there are costs. So how did that all come about? Was that difficult, time-consuming?
Yeah, well, I'd say there were stresses along the way and concerns. We were very, I think, motivated by some of the serious difficulties we had with ArcIMS. And I should say it was partly because we hadn't really kept pace with ArcIMS over time. And I'm not trying to write off ArcIMS, because I think if we were to go now to ArcGIS server, it may provide a solution to some of the issues that we had. But they provided quite a strong motivation. There were things that just weren't working at all, and quite clear differences in terms of functionality, in terms of slippy maps and having a Google map backdrop and a full screen application that was just so obvious from the word go that they kind of let us override some of the complications. I think that the biggest hurdle for me personally was the realization that I could directly alter the code and play a part in the ongoing development. And with ArcIMS, we had a web developer who had full responsibility for it. He had admin rights through it all and everything, and I just had to effectively work with him. Because with an open source environment, the code was all there. It was all JavaScript. If I spoke fluent JavaScript, then my problems would be sorted. But I actually found that very empowering because I just needed to invest the time to work through and see the logic of it. And the code for what we are doing is amazingly simple, surprisingly simple. And so in spite of some of the hurdles and the concerns, I think potentially it might be slightly less robust in terms of some kind of, you know, business model than perhaps paying licensing fees to support to one of the big sort of GIS companies. I'm quite sure that there are those sorts of issues, but generally we found it a really kind of good move to make. Yeah, I'd certainly recommend others to do the same too. And we were in a dialogue actually last year about how easy it would be to extend some of this out to the Who Owns Scotland website, and we'd be really keen to continue that too. Yeah, I think it's just people ran out of time really.
Kate in the front.
I want to ask about that it is, Chris. I got the text, and the way one of the things that's quite nice is looking at text that has place name mentions and allowing one to plot the journey on a map. And the way through the connection has to be a gazetteer. You said that somebody has done the pond maps well.
Yeah.
I was wondering, it's
11,000 names it is as well.
I was wondering, you mentioned earlier that you didn't have gazetteers for all of the layers. I'm just wondering if you could say briefly where you have got gazetteers and where you haven't.
Yeah, well, really, actually, our gazetteer at the moment for the applications is just the Google gazetteer. We have a county parish drop-down. But if you wanted, say, names from the Ordnance Survey mapping of the mid-19th century, as far as I'm aware, it's not been compiled. And I know, talking to Bruce, actually, before Christmas about work he's been doing about the Ordnance Survey Land Ranger gazetteer at a modern level. I know that, I have to say, in terms of historic data, there are probably better people around the room to point to the way forward. But as I see it, the main problem is that the way of extracting and gathering that information involves significant labour at the moment, that the text is there, and obviously if you slog it into a spreadsheet in the right way, then it'll make it available. But in terms of OCRing and mining and doing the work that you've been doing in informatics, with addressing history, the process involved a lot of manual input because it was very tricky to automate and predict the positions of texts on pages and so on. A lot of the historic gazetteers don't easily lend themselves towards the kind of extraction that we're wanting. And another opportunity that I've seen at a pilot level is the actual crowdsourcing of names from georeferenced maps. And this is something I think that the National Library of Wales have as a pilot project, but by actively delivering georeferenced maps and encouraging the right kind of interface, then people can actually read the names, obviously for an area they're interested in, with the right tools effectively input the names. And again, I think there's potential in that. It's just whether that would actually deliver the mass set of names for a geographically diverse area like Scotland. Some areas you'll probably get very quickly. But you'd be spending a lot of time, I think, waiting for the crowd in other bits of Scotland.
Is technology likely to address that, you know, in the near future? Is there anything on the horizon that, I mean, as you say, it's either a labour-intensive project over a long period of time, on how much labour you get, and then, like the last week of the project, new technology comes out, and you've done it all in, like, you know, running a machine over a weekend or something. Is there anything like that? Up to the character recognition technology or anything like that? Any improvements in the horizon? horizon there?
Yeah, well, there's a number of projects underway. I mean, I know it's actually connected to England, but there is a project called LEAP, which is the Digital Exposure of English Place Names project. It's a big project that's been going on, we'll report this summer, and it's digitised all of the volumes that you may know of the English Place Name Survey, which is a very detailed survey of all of the historic places, often not on maps, but actually on other early documents and charters, and it's done it in a very clever way, so it'll expose it as linked data, and it'll reveal a mass of very rich content like that. The Vision of Britain project that I mentioned, which has involved particularly Humphrey Southall and a chap called Paul L. at Queen's University Belfast, have done a lot of work on OCRing historic texts and gazetteers, and have a number of other projects in the pipeline. We supported a bid last year, which was to the EU, for a kind of crowdsourced tool that would allow people to input place names from georeference maps that didn't, in the end, get funded. And Humphrey Southall is also making a Heritage Lottery Fund bid in this area. But I'd be very keen to hear of other ideas. I mean, from our point of view, it requires making the right bid to the right body to support it, because I think that the results can be delivered to the community and are very evident, say, someone like yourself in a community like ours. The trick is to kind of make those results obvious to those involved in the decision. And gazetteers and texts, I think, often don't seem to capture the same sort of attention, but I don't know. Bruce, you're the expert in this area. You're a gazetteer in Scotland.
Yes, distinctly unsexy, but and many of our view absolutely crucial in terms of linking things together, and that's their value. But I don't think that's been properly recognised. As Chris said, you know, I've done some work trying to boot together something with Cameron's help and funding. There's a sort of definitive contemporary gazetteer, but the historical side, there's lots of small projects that have done stuff and it's trying to link. I think the Royal Commission is working on that one, but it's a big and almost endless story, unfortunately. But it, exactly as you say, Kate, to be able to have a gazetteer gives you that ability to start pulling things out of text, and there's many more text than there will ever be maps, so actually it really allows us to do very interesting things.
Can you just define what you mean by a gazetteer? What specifically you mean by it?
Simple terms, a list of names, a list of coordinates, and usually some kind of administrative geography or and/or feature type for these. So what we would traditionally call a short form gazetteer, we're talking about in this context, as against something that's a long descriptive gazetteer.
So another thing where it is XY coordinate and some sort of other administrative place context, like a bigger area or whatever.
Yeah, we did a survey of them. We did that meeting in the Royal Commission 3 years ago, and there are an amazing number of them about, and they are all completely incompatible because they've all been built for either different purposes, different sources, different people. But it's getting the force to bring them all together is the challenge.
Why are they incompatible? It's just simple components, it sounds like. What's the technical?
We're in danger of getting into something seminar here, which I may or may not get some point in the future. Possibly a better conversation to have in this pub.
It all becomes clear after 5 minutes.
Two questions lined up, they're all set to go, and I think Bruce does have some more to say, so it's always a good sign of a talk if we get all the way around the room, so on that note, we'll go that way.
Okay, Bruce, just have a question about crowdsourcing. What sort of uptake have you had from the public, and has it been worth the effort to do that? And also, how do you go about validating what people do your references and processing or buying this?
Yeah, that's a good question, a really good question. In the references, the slide before this one, I wrote a little paper with Petta and a girl called Kimberly Cole at the British Library all about our experiences with georeferencer. And those kind of questions are covered in there with our answers to them, because the experience was actually very different between the libraries. The experience in NLS was the worst of all in terms of update. But it's partly because I don't think I promoted it that well. We had our concerns about some of the functionality and some of the things we were expecting to improve that then took a while before they were implemented. At the British Library, they used social media particularly to promote it, and the results were incredible. Like 700 or 800 maps, all georeferenced within 5 days. They prepared a press release to go out about it, which they didn't need to send because they hadn't done in that time. And they've released batches of maps since that have also been really popular. The experience of the new software is very good, and I do think that the interface has played a key part to that in providing an easy, encouraging interface that people have no problem with at all, and they can quickly see the result, enjoy the result, and find other things to do. In terms of validation, the georeference requires a registration, and that was one of the problems of the early functionality, that it didn't work as quickly. The instruction information often got misdelivered in people's spam boxes, and so a year and a bit ago it was improved so that people could use a Facebook account or Google account or LinkedIn, I think, as well, and that made the registration really easy, which was good because people were straight in there and using it. But the registration was partly to kind of control any, you know, potential vandalism or misuse, and I'm not aware of that, actually. I think the only misuse has been people who sat on the mouse, or the mouse dropped off the table, or something like that. Yeah, you could tell something terrible happened at a control point, and they can go back and delete it.
Yeah, that's right.
The British Library actually do validate the results, which is really easy to do. I mean, just skipping through them and doing a visual eyeballing of approximately whether it's in the right area. And the back end to georeferencer records how many control points for the maps. And so ones that are below a certain threshold, if there's only 10 points or something, the georeference is not likely to be that good for a lot of these maps. And so it's quite easy to manage that too. The areas that georeferencer is more limited on at the moment is it can't do multiple maps. And that's actually quite important for things like series maps. It's also not easy to crop the margins from maps and seam them together. And so we did a project which was funded by Wilbur, not by crowdsourcing, these environmental surveyors, where we cropped and seamed together 6,000 ordnance survey maps that are at the 6-inch to the mile scale in the 1890s. And that was hard work. The chap doing it spent four to five months doing it. And I think that I still find it difficult to see how that kind of work is crowdsourceable, because there's a lot of kind of hard labour involved in it. And the fun part of zooming in and out of an old map and enjoying the map kind of can become too much like drudgery for the kind of mass georeferencer series. But it's early days with crowdsourcing, and obviously there's huge success stories out there, and so I think it's got a good potential. We're kind of at the beginning, I hope, of doing a lot more with it.
Right. Very efficient,
right?
I
think
it's introducing some of this
Scotland's. The Scotland's Places Gazetteer.
Yeah. Because they've done it around Sutton's
That's not the gazetteer you've got online in Scotland's Places. Yeah. And but that's a contemporary gazetteer, it's a current
gazetteer. They're also starting to look at digitising the old Scotland inputs.
Yeah.
First edition.
Yeah.
That would be means the
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. Thanks for mentioning that, Peter. Yeah, with the Scotland's Places, I didn't mention this, but the National Records of Scotland have the Ordnance Survey name books, and these are the names that were debated on by the Ordnance Survey and put onto the first edition mapping between the 1840s and 1880s. And they often record variant names and the authorities they consulted for them. And they should all be digitised by the summer, is that right? I think it's quite a rapid progress, because I've seen quite a lot more go online. Subscription-based, isn't it? Yeah, so yeah, there's definitely a crowdsourcing project there as well. Okay, thanks.
Can I ask at the other end of the scale, there's apparently a part on GIS in the new, did I say the word, Curriculum of Excellence at level 4. Now you mentioned your great escape in Murray and Elgin. Have you considered doing any collaboration work with either education authorities or...
We would like to. Our main problem is we don't have a great deal to offer them other than geo-referenced maps and the ways that these can be made available. And to develop a good application, it involves quite a significant chunk of work, usually in creating the right kind of content for the educational community. So the Great Escapes had several thousand pounds worth of money involving a developer and an outside consultants. They got special dedicated funding for it. And so if there was a project like that where there was that kind of resource available, we'd be only too happy to do that. We will be working on a project that's described a bit more on the back page of CAIRT, called Mapping the Nation, which is actually connected to the book of the same name, but it's funding from a lady called Dr. Anna Groundwater, who's based in English Literature in Edinburgh University. And the main aim of it is to bring together geographic and cartographic content connected to Scotland and develop resources for schools. And it will be a kind of annual programme that will deliver a workshop and event in the early months of next year. So we're hoping through that, we've got a project in mind for NLS, but I think it will involve a lot more work and time to do. And I don't know if it's people here from ELENA, but their DigiMap for Schools application, you may know, provides historic maps for schools. And they've said, certainly to me, it's a hard job encouraging use and uptake in schools, really. They need full-time people who can liaise and coordinate with the schools, getting the teachers on board, training them up, getting them to work. It's not just put a website up there. And so, you know, it's that kind of, yeah, we're really keen to do it.
I'm old enough to have been involved in the original Doomsday project from the BBC. So I know when we visited it, I asked us how important it was for them to see the technology and the sort of way information was collected in this, then as it was in the 200s, you know, when we were looking at it, yeah. So I think there's a possibility here of wider exposure, that's all.
Yeah, good. Okay, lovely, yeah, thank you for that.
Okay, various thank yous to take. We're going to rush on the bar for geo drinks at 1:30, courtesy of the AGI. I'll hand over to Bruce in a minute, but I'd personally like to say thanks to Chris for a very interesting and useful talk, and hopefully lots of potential for collaboration, and thank my volunteers for their sterling efforts, to all of you as well for coming. I'll hand over to Bruce, who'd like to say a few things, a couple of announcements.
Yes, I don't want to keep people back from geo drinks, but I just wanted to thank Chris on behalf of all of us. I think he's given us a glimpse into an enormous body of work that's gone on at the National Library, for which we need to be enormously grateful. I've known Chris for many years. He's one of the most modest people I've ever met, and he's terribly good at acknowledging everybody else's work and then really not mentioning the amount that he's done. But I think it was put into focus with me at a meeting we were at together a few months ago, where the statistic was made clear that the National Library of Scotland, really through Chris, entirely through Chris, has 50,000 digitised, scanned, online georeferenced maps. The Library of Congress in the US, with all of its enormous resources and so on, has managed to get up to 1,000 maps online. So I think in Scotland we have this remarkable body of information, not just complete coverage of one timescale, but going through multiple series of maps. And I think it was Chris's efforts and also his real commitment, that the point was made in terms of that this public data should be available for free. So I think for that we are immensely grateful, but also for this afternoon's presentation, Chris, we'd like to thank you very much. was also asking to mention in an AGI context, the AGI Scottish Conference is on the University of Glasgow on the 27th of February, if you don't know about that. It's a fantastically good deal for students, but I think our students all know about it. It's a pretty good deal for everybody else as well. The keynote speaker is Mike Nielsen, who's the head of digital for the Scottish Government, and there are a number, it's actually a three-track conference this year, I think, so there's a number of other interesting speakers, so if you don't know about that one, do come along to them as well. In the meantime, do your drinks, finish up what's at the back, and let's go have a drink. Thank you very much indeed.